I say 17, that's where we're going to begin studying today, but go back please to chapter 12 for the setting. In chapter 12, verse 7, God had said to Abram as follows. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." Now, not only does this pertain to the promise to give to Abraham's descendants the land of Palestine or the land of Canaan, but notice there also is implied that Abram obviously is going to have children. And therefore, if we go back to Genesis chapter 12 and verse 7, you have the promise of descendants. And the first thing we need to note about the word descendants, and we've said this several times, and it's very important, is to recall that the Old Testament is written in Hebrew in the original and the New Testament in Greek. And therefore, we have to be very careful that the English translation reflects the original accurately. And at this point, there is a little bit of a problem in the translation, not that it's wrong, but there is a note we really need, and that is the fact that descendants is not plural. The word in the original is your seed. And the important feature is singular. Not your seed, plural, your seed, singular. And the reason for that is found in Galatians 3, verse 17, where Paul says, when God made the promise to Abram, he didn't make it to seeds as of many, but to a seed as of one, that is Christ. And therefore, when God makes the promise to Abram, he's simply saying, we'll start with you and we'll move down through the line for many, many, many centuries until we arrive at the singular seed of Christ. And therefore, in chapter 12, verse 7, he obviously expected that he was going to have a seed. Now, if we move over here to where we're going to be today in Genesis 17, we are looking at a period between the making of that promise that he would have a seed, a period of some 24 years. Gives us time perspective. Everything in chapter 12 through 17 really has to do with that promise that God made to Abraham. And from the perspective of chapter 17, it's been some 20 years. Basically, you can say that the promise coming up through these 24 years has been 24 years, and we can put over it one single word. It has been 24 years of absolute frustration on the part of Abram and Sarah because they had no children. And the thing that would make it that frustrating is that every time they got down about it, God came along and said, well, let's up the promise, go out, count the stars of the sky, and so shall your seed be. It had been a source of tremendous frustration. So if we move down the timeline, and let's move down the timeline to Genesis 15. And over this period of some 10 years, which would had passed since God made the promise in Genesis 15, Abram and Sarah had finally settled down and said, well, we do have a male servant, and by the laws and the customs of our day, the male servant can be the heir, and therefore they had Eliezer. And Abram and Sarah had decided that, well, we will accept Eliezer as the heir. God comes back, Genesis 15 and verse 4, and says, this man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he will be your heir. And so God comes along and says, no, it is not going to be Eliezer at all. If we move down farther on the timeline to Genesis chapter 16, Sarah and Abram again tire of waiting. They are frustrated that the promise is not being fulfilled, and they utilize a custom of the day. And the custom of the day is recorded in what we have found now to be the Nuzu tablets. And the Nuzu tablets record that a husband and wife that are childless may follow the following procedure. She may take her servant, give to her husband, and he can have children by her. Well, in chapter 16, they resort to that as a viable solution, and to them, or to Abram rather, is born Ishmael. And so the steps are, number one, if it's to be Eliezer, Abram will not be the father, Sarah will not be the mother, it will simply be an adoption process. And God says, no, that's not the way it is to be. With the birth of Ishmael, Abram is the true father, but Sarah is not the true mother, and God says it will not be that way. And when he says it will not be that way, you would think that they would anticipate that, well, we're going to have a son immediately. God simply says, no, it will not be Ishmael. And then another 13 plus years pass. Apparently Abram and Sarah thought, and using the custom of the time to have Ishmael, that this would be a legitimate helping hand to God to bring a fulfillment of the promise. Nothing comes out of this except frustration. Nothing comes of it but difficulty. After 13 more years, we now arrive at chapter 17. Now let me circle that 13 years and say, why was God silent for 13 years? Why the silence of God after the birth of Ishmael for a period of 13 years? Why did he do that? And there are two possible answers to that. Number one, God was silent to test and to nurture Abraham's faith. In other words, God was simply saying, Abram, can you look at the circumstances, look at my promise, and come back to my promise every time? Can you believe me even when the circumstances seem to deny me? So, the test would be God's word or God's promise versus appearances. And that would be the test. And you could say, well, that certainly explains adequately why it is that God allows these 13 years and ultimately 23, 24 years to pass, is because God is testing him. There is another possibility about the 13 years, and it could be this, that when Abraham and Sarah had a son by utilizing the common custom of the day, they were not leaving things in God's hand, and therefore the reason for the 13 years is they were remedial discipline for impatience. And I see no reason why both can't be involved. The remedial, the teaching discipline, because they were impatient, would also tend to test and to nurture Abraham's faith. And so really, both possibilities come into the picture and help explain what that really is. Now, we're coming down to chapter 17, and all this is backdrop and background for it. And in chapter 17, the essential message is this. We'll simply call and caption chapter 17. I'll put it in a quote. God says to Abram in this chapter, and Sarah, you will have a son. By Sarah. Name him Isaac. And I will make the same promise to him that I made to you. I will make my covenant agreement with him. That, in essence, is what chapter 17 of Genesis is all about. And I repeat, Abram, you need to understand, you are going to have a son by Sarah. Name him Isaac, and I will make my covenant with him. And therefore, we can kind of give a preliminary outline of chapter 17. It falls into two parts as to content. Part one is the appearance of God to Abram. The appearance of God is 17:1 through 22. And let's note verse 1 and verse 22, and you'll see how this fits together as a unit. Verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said to him. And if you come down and read through the verses, through verse 21 concludes God's last sentence, but my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. And when he had finished talking with him, God went up from Abraham. So you have a theophany, an appearance of God, and that's in chapter 1, verse 22. That appearance revolves, in turn, about three things. Number one, the promise. God remakes the promise in 17:2 through 8. 17:2 says, I will establish my covenant between me and you. And he continues to expand and supplement that covenant down to through verse 8. Now, added in chapter 17 is there is something physical added as the sign of the covenant. 17, verse 9, through verse 14. And the sign will be that which throughout the Old Testament said of any Israelite, you have a relationship to God because you have the sign of the covenant, which is circumcision. Then, with verse 15, God gives an explanation. 17:15 through verse 22. And the new news that comes along in verse 15 is God said to Abraham, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. And with that, Abraham responds with laughter, and you have the words and the further explanation of the covenant. Then, when you get to the last half of Genesis 17, you have, beginning with verse 23, Abraham took Ishmael, his son, and all the servants who were born in the house, who were bought with this money, every male among the men of Abram's household, and circumcised the flesh. And therefore you have an emphasis now on the obedience of Abraham. Appearance of God, 17:1-22, the obedience of Abraham, 17:23, to the end of the chapter, verse 27. And that's the way we will handle the rest of this chapter. Now, we'll also need to add a third point. And the third point will be to the birth of both Ishmael and to Isaac, we will find the Bible giving it a doctrinal significance. And the doctrinal significance is simply this. Isaac was born supernaturally. And Galatians will say that is like the fact that we must be born supernaturally. Isaac was the miracle baby. The Christian is a miracle baby. We must be born from above and so forth. And Galatians will deal with that concept and it will give it a doctrinal significance. All right, let's start then with the appearance of God, 17:1-22. And first, in verse 1, will be its setting. The appearance of God, or the theophany, 17:1-22, and we begin with the setting. By the way, and I'm sure some of you will be interested, I had not mentioned it to you previously, but in October of 1990, we will be having a pastor's conference here, and we've been able to confirm one of the speakers that I'm sure you'll be interested in, because some of you have his Bible. We have been able to confirm that Dr. Charles Ryrie will be here in October to speak for us. I don't know how that fits in Genesis 17, but it just came to my mind. Flitting mind. Okay, the setting. Notice, first of all, in chapter 17, notation is made of Abraham's age. Now, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him. Now, the question that comes up at this point is, why is it necessary to throw in his age? And therefore, we should ask, why is it important, and why does God say anything about his age? Well, the age coincides with the fact that he could not have children. Now, there's a little interesting phenomena here. If you go over to Romans 4, verse 19, it's very clear that at this point, Abraham and Sarah physically could not have children. Romans chapter 4, verse 19. Now, we don't want to make this entirely due to age. While it is true in our day, you don't have children at age 99, either male or female. We don't want to simply write off Abraham as saying, well, the only reason he couldn't have children was his age. Anyone know why? Because when he was 137, he had a whole bunch of kids. So it will not purely be age consideration, but at 99, not just because of age, but for whatever reason, we have Romans 4 and verse 19, speaking of Abram. Notice the last part of verse 18 has the, well, let's go to 18. It says, in hope against hope he believed, in order that he might become the father of many nations, according to that which he had spoken, quote, so shall your seed be. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body now as good as dead. And I take it good as dead means dead sexually. He could not have children. Since he was about 100 years old and the deadness of Sarah's womb. And so the emphasis is sexually both Sarah and Abram could not have children. But be careful about making that purely a matter of age. Hebrews chapter 11 makes the same point. Chapter 11, verse 12. Therefore also there was born of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in number, etc. So notice that at age 99, he was regarded as both Sarah and Abram, very definite, underscored fact, they could not have children at that particular age. The significance of that, I think, comes along to the fact that when God, at age 99, made this old guy potent, he was potent for a long time. Because if you go to Genesis chapter 25, Sarah has died, and Abraham takes a second wife. Abram took another wife whose name was Keturah, and she bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. There's some good names for people who insist on biblical names for your children. And so forth, and they have children. And notice finally down in verse 7, all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years, and we put some other chronology, we find out that Abram was having these children up to about age 137. So why age? At this point, he could not have children. And he was later, with the birth of Isaac, he was made potent for 37 more years. But at this point, unable to have children. Now notice in chapter 17, going back to it, Abram was 99 years old. The Lord appeared to him and said to him, I am God Almighty. God Almighty is the Hebrew expression El Shaddai, E-L-S-H-A-D-D-A-I. And if you trace that name of God, it does mean truly God All-Powerful. But if you trace the usage of it, it is usually the name that is employed. It is the name that is employed in the Old Testament to show that God has power to fulfill His promises. But there is another note that goes with it. It's the name employed to show God has power to fulfill His word. And the other situation that inevitably goes with that particular name, El Shaddai, is He can fulfill His word even when all forces of nature say no. When everything says no. Why did God wait and wait and wait and wait some 24 years after He made the promises for Abram and Sarah to have a son? He did that for a very, very definite reason, and the definite reason is this: in order to let every possible human resource dry up. As long as it was possible to man, God says, I can't do it, and I will not do it. And that is a biblical principle. Because we do not find personal salvation, we do not become a Christian until we recognize it's on the basis of grace. And grace says no merit is required on your part. You must simply believe. And therefore, we do not come to personal salvation until we're willing to let go of everything human that would accomplish it. We realize it can't be done by my works, by my effort, by my trying, by my pushing, by my squeezing, anything that I can do. The moment we let go of all the human resources, God can move. And therefore, Abraham and Sarah are a beautiful illustration of that basic principle. Why do you have to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait? You have to wait and wait and wait and wait because God does not act until the situation is totally impossible. And when the situation is totally impossible, Romans 4, Hebrews 11, Abram is dead sexually. Sarah is dead sexually, and therefore both can say, there is no hope. Then God says, now I can take over. And I can do something, because I can do something on the basis of grace, which is my method for dealing with it. All right, then, the setting. The setting is to bring Abraham and Sarah to the point where the birth of the child is impossible. Number two, God then gives to them the promise. And the promise runs in verses 2 through 8. Now, it's important to recognize that the first thing that God does in dealing with Abraham is to assign to Abraham, what is in your life the fundamental issue? And by way of expansion and principle, what is the fundamental, single, solitary issue in any life? You and God. Me and God. The essential issue is vertical relationship. So let's put fundamental issue and I'll put it in quote marks, God speaking, the fundamental issue is you and me. Beginning with the words, I am God Almighty, walk before me. And so the two issues are, walk before me. Walk before me means you need to develop a mental attitude of God consciousness. God conscious thinking. And that's involved in the words, walk before me. Abram, basic issue, you need to become God conscious in terms of relationship. And therefore, the issue that I'm going to handle first is not the birth of the child. That's going to come into the picture. But let's get down to the bottom line. Let's get down to the real fundamentals. You need to walk before me. God-conscious kind of thinking, or conscious of relationship to me. Number two, you are to be blameless. And let me give you some of the ideas that are involved in the word tamim, or the word blameless. The word blameless, and you may have a translation if you've got an older Bible. Perfect, anyone have that? Be perfect? Okay. The idea involved in the word is not the idea of perfection, but here are the synonyms. It's anything that is sound, anything that is complete. It is also used in context of anything that is in accord with facts, that is in harmony with truth. So walk before me and be sound, be complete, live in accord with fact, live in accord with truth. That's the fundamental, basic issue. And we've gone over it so many times here, but for those who may not have seen or heard it, remember the old principle of the triangle. And at the top of the triangle is God, and the base of the triangle represents any and all human relationships. Husband, wife, believer to believer, child to parent, believer to government, all relationships running along the base of the triangle. And as we've said many, many times, if we were going to say, what does the Bible have to say about personal relationships, and try to teach it like that, there's nothing in the Bible that talks about how a husband and wife, child, parent, believer, and believer relate to one another without introducing the top of the triangle. Husbands, love your wives because wives are lovable. No. Husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it.
Wives, be in submission to your husbands, because husbands are always right. Wrong. Wife, be in subjection to your husband, and it's related to, as unto the Lord. Top of the triangle. Believer to believer, forgiving one another because we each ask for forgiveness. Ephesians 4:32. No. Forgiving one another, believer to believer, because God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven us. Top of the triangle. Children, obey your parents because they are always right. No. Children, obey your parents, and the relationship is because you do that, and so doing, you honor God. Believer relationship to government, 1 Peter 2:13. Submitting yourselves to every ordinance of man because the ordinances of men are so brilliant? No. Submitting yourself to every ordinance of man because these ordinances are ultimately back in the sovereignty of God. And therefore, in any relationship on this horizontal level, if it's a husband-wife or a girlfriend-boyfriend, and if you can't run it through the top of the triangle, both husband and wife relating to the Lord, child and parent relating to the Lord, then the relationship is not one that can be founded on a biblical basis. That's the case for not marrying an unbeliever. You can't operate off the top of the triangle. God has no place in their life, and consequently, they can be nothing run through the top of the triangle, and consequently, the relationship is impossible. And God is simply saying to Abraham, Abraham first, you walk with me. Relationship to Sarah, relationship to the seed, relationship to everything else is secondary to one thing, and that is you must learn to walk with me as the God who can fulfill and does fulfill His Word. Now, we're going to stop at this point because we need to conclude with communion and say a few words about it. We observe this morning the Lord's Supper. And the Lord's Supper, very basically, is commemorative. When we come to the end of, or midway in Genesis chapter 17, God will give to Abraham as a sign of the covenant a ritual. It will be the ritual of circumcision. And when we go to that ritual, we'll make two observations of all rituals. The Lord's table is a ritual in a good sense. I don't mean in a performing sense. Baptism is a ritual. And the two things we need to say about any and every ritual, even God-given ones, is ritual inevitably outlives the memory of its significance. Given time, everybody hangs to the ritual and forgets what it is all about. And the second characteristic is that ritual usually replaces the reality it was intended to signify. And that can very easily be the case with something like the Lord's Supper, and that's why it is important to take a little time and say what is it all about. As the Lord was ready to die on the cross, He took the bread and He took the cup and said, "This is my body, which is," and here are the key words, "for you." And the word "for" means in substitution for, in sacrificial substitution for. So as we take the cup and the bread this morning, we're simply saying this. When Jesus Christ died on the cross, He died in my place. The guilt that belonged to me was placed over there. The penalty for sin that should have fallen on me fell on Him. There's a word for that. G-O-S-P-E-L. Gospel means good news. And that is truly good news. That the work of Jesus Christ is sufficient on the cross for us. And as we take this morning, we are proclaiming to the world that we're trusting nothing less than His work.